Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Soon after the Night of Broken Glass in Austria and Germany in 1938, the government of Great Britain resolved to accept unaccompanied Jewish children from those countries and find them safe places to stay as the Third Reich tightened its murderous chokehold on Jewish populations in their home countries. In all, nearly 10,000 children found refuge through the initiative that came to be known as the Kindertransport, including a remarkably gifted 14-year-old pianist named Lisa, chosen by her parents to travel abroad alone precisely because she had her passion for music to give her comfort and strength through the separation. The initiative saved her life, and she grew up to raise two daughters who became concert pianists themselves. One of them is Mona Golubic, who wrote about her mother's experiences in the 2002 book The Children of Williston Lane, Beyond the Kindertransport, a memoir of music, love, and survival. She's in town to perform tomorrow night at the Wiley Theater in Dallas. Mona, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
Your show tells your mother's story. The book tells your mother's story. It is a remarkable one. Was she a natural storyteller, or did you have to draw all this out of her?
Oh, she was an amazing storyteller. In my piano lessons with her when I was a little girl, she was my piano teacher, she always said to me, Mona, each piece of music tells a story, but you have to discover what that story is. So in those piano lessons, in between the Beethoven sonatas and the Chopin nocturnes and the black notes on the white paper, she told me the story of her life because she felt that it would make the music come so alive. So it was about Beethoven, for example, when she would go into the composers, being quite disheveled in his apartment and how the maid would have to come in and pick up the coins underneath the clothes. It was about Chopin being involved with Jourdain. Eventually, as I got older, she told me that story. But then again, we would be in a Chopin nocturne, and out of nowhere, she would say to me, well, Mona, did I ever tell you the time that Johnny King Kong read poetry to me at nighttime when the bombs came down? And I thought, who was Johnny King Kong? But we went right back into the Chopin nocturne. And then a couple of beats later, it would be, well, what about when Aaron whistled the Grieg piano concerto to me? So I knew that her young years were about taking a train ride, escaping from a darkness, growing up in the storied Vienna of Mahler and Beethoven and Schubert, having a dream to become a concert pianist, separation from her family, and living with these mysterious characters that became a makeshift family to each other and ultimately sweethearts to each other.
At least in the book, her first realization that things would never be the same again were when her piano teacher in Vienna said to her, I can no longer teach you because you're a Jew.
Right. And I think that's such a powerful, universal, global, timeless issue, and why we are, why I'm so privileged that how it resonates to today and to young people today, because very much a lot of my target audiences are middle and high school students when we go across America to bring the story through the book. They are facing those challenges today. History teaches us that prejudice is a constant, ugly truth in our lives. In my mother's case, it was unthinkable that here is a young girl coming every Friday on her magical trolley ride to the most important hour of her week, to the center of Vienna, the beautiful buildings, the cafes. She wants to be part of this society. She wants to make her debut. And she walks in to start the Beethoven Moonlight Sonata and her first lesson of the Grieg piano concerto. And her teacher tells her, I can't teach you anymore because you're different. You belong to a religion that is going to be prejudiced against. Who could have even fathomed that the most horrible Holocaust would be around the corner, that would remove one-third of that of those people from the planet Earth? The kinds of Holocausts that we know are taking place today all around the world. So that's unfathomable.
Your mother had very vivid memories of Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. and it affected the neighborhood. She also saw her father humiliated in a way that when you're 13 or 14, it's almost like you couldn't pick a worse age to see someone that you care about violated in this way.
That's very profound what you're saying. And I remember that when I was a young girl, we had a Shabbat meal. We were with friends in someone's home. And out of nowhere, my mother shared with everyone what she shared that moment of from a window in November 1938, looking out onto the street and seeing my grandfather, her father, made to bend down into the streets, wash the streets as the Nazis were screaming epitaphs and you know, tremendously horrible words at them. And I saw when I looked in my mother's eyes and her face that night at that dinner table, the terrible effect that it had on her to share that with all of us. But there was a kind of disconnect, too. It took me a long time to understand that whatever happened to my mother at that train station when she got on the train and it sped away, you're 14 years old, the shock of not knowing what's going to happen to you, how she must have, how did she deal with that? How did she have the strength to be on that train, to go to a foreign country not knowing? And it's the reason that I wrote the book. It's the reason that I've made this my mission. She was chosen because she had her music. The Jura family, my grandparents, had a terrible, terrible decision to make because there were three girls. There was the young one, Sonia, 12 years old. There was Rosie, the beauty, 17, and my mother, 14. And they chose my mother, they told her, because they thought the music would give her the strength to face an uncertain future. It would become something inside of her that she could hold on to. And that's really one of the great messages of this book and the story, or at least what we try to impart in our work, that if you have something to hold on to in the darkest of times, you have a chance of making your way through. And I think for young people today, immigrants coming to this country, young people from broken families, young people facing incredible challenges all over this country in a very, very complex 21st century that we live in, the message is find your passion, find something inside yourself, find those things that you can have gratitude for and build on them to get through tough times.
When your mother was on the train, she helped save a baby's life. And it's really a chilling story and a beautiful one at the same time. A parent, when the train stopped, lifted a basket through an open window and it had a baby inside.
That happened a lot along the train ride, I was told. I'm also told in the research that we did that some parents put their children on the train. And then as the train was starting to flow out of the station, yanked their children through the window back out of just so much pain that they couldn't let their child leave. And of course, that was the wrong decision because ultimately those families, I often say that there were trains to the east and trains to the west. To the west was freedom and survival to England, and to the east was pretty much certain death.
You can understand that, though, as an adult, right? I mean, I sent my kids to summer camp and spent the whole drive home worrying that they might not be happy, and that's such a silly, frivolous thing. The courage that it took for parents to send their children, knowing that this would probably save their lives, but that they couldn't guarantee a good outcome, they couldn't supervise, they couldn't know what was happening with their children every day. That's more emotional strength than I think many people could summon.
Yes, it's one of the last lines in the play and in the book that we say that this is a tribute to every mother and father who had the courage to save their child by saying goodbye.
So they were sent to England. Those who were teenagers, school was over. They were given safe places to stay, but for the most part, they just needed to get out and support themselves. They needed to find jobs.
And they were placed in different, you know, some of them were placed in the hostels. Some of them were placed in farms. Some of them were placed as domestic help. There was a little bit of a controversy there regarding that. Many of the children still went to school. A lot of them had to get jobs. My mom had still some schooling. At that age, they quickly absorbed the English language, and she spoke perfect, beautiful English. But the big thing, when she finally made her way to 243 Wilsdon Lane and lived among 30 refugee children, Gina, who became her best friend, who is still alive today, and at the age of 91 came to New York to see my show when we opened it last summer off Broadway. And of course, I made sure that Gina got up in the audience and took a bow in front of everyone. And ever since, she's calling me every week to say, when do I get to go on the road with you? I mean, she was pretty thrilled about that. But Gina, who was 15 years old in the hostel, also from Vienna, took my mother under her wings. They became best friends and got her a job in the East End of London, working long hours on the sewing machines, making uniforms for the army, for the RAF, because the war was coming.
Mr. Dimble, the foreman, placed two pieces of navy blue cloth on a large sewing machine. He instructed me to lift the presser foot, insert the cloths, lower the foot, and I began to sew. Each stitch was like another note of music. Passages rising, passages falling. The combination of notes and interlocking threads creates a straight line of attached music, and a simple cloth with some threads becomes a beautiful tapestry. A tapestry fit for a princess. Now, Princess Elizabeth lives at Buckingham Palace, which I had seen on the double-decker bus ride. Princess Elizabeth is the same age as I am. Oh, to be a princess in this glorious place called London. One more push on the pedal. Another line of stitching. And the factory bell announces the end of my day.
That is my guest, concert pianist Mona Golubic, who will perform her one-woman show tomorrow night at the Wiley Theater in Dallas. She's also author of a related 2002 book called The Children of Williston Lane, Beyond the Kinder Transport, a memoir of music, love, and survival. Mona, it's lovely to listen to. What people don't get by just hearing this on the radio is what your hands are doing. The way they're moving back and forth reminded me of nothing more than the way a sewing machine goes back and forth to get the stitches underneath and over the cloth. I'm guessing you could have put your hands in a lot of different positions to play that, but it's obvious that you're trying to create something visual in addition to creating an oral experience for your audience.
Well, I take no credit for that segment that your listeners just experienced. That is the genius of the producer, director, adapter of the book for the show. His name is Hershey Felder. And actually, right now, he's in Houston doing his one-person show on the life of Gershwin to great success and great reviews. He took me under his wings. He fell in love with the story. He loved the book. He adapted it for the stage. He gave me a chance, because I had a dream, to bring the story to the stage. He gave me a chance and built the theatrical production. And one of the segments that he created was, how can we create this feeling through music of your mother being at a sewing machine? Now, the trick in that particular segment, and it's ironic that you chose that, that has to be one of the hardest segments in the entire play. Every time I approach that, I kind of do a couple of prayers ahead of time, because it's so difficult to play that Bach partita where my hands are crossing, as you said, and speak at the same time. I would fumble on my words in the rehearsals. I would fumble in getting the Bach in place. But I think after 400 performances of the one-person show, it goes into the fabric of your muscles and your memory, and you get more confident in doing things. And it does bring me to the issue of the fact that he found a very artful way to cut the music with the words.
We're speaking this hour with my guest, Mona Golubic. She will perform tomorrow night at the Wiley Theater in Dallas. We'll come back to our conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with concert pianist and author Mona Golubic. Her book is called The Children of Williston Lane, Beyond the Kinder Transport, A Memoir of Music, Love, and Survival. It's the basis for the one-person show she will perform tomorrow night at the Wiley Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. All right, how did your mother end up at Williston Lane in this hostel run by a woman who, at first glance, seemed pretty intimidating?
Great question, in that it points to, there's probably three reasons why I wrote the book, and that question that you've asked me is one of the reasons. Because when she arrived to London, she was told by her family that she was going to be taken in by some distant cousins. That didn't happen. I don't want to give away the story as to why, because I'm hoping folks will come tomorrow or read the book. But she ended up in the countryside in a place called Peacock Manor. It was almost like a castle in her dreams. And she had enough to eat. People were kind to her. The staff was kind. She was never allowed to play the piano that was in the parlor. So for many months, at nighttime when everyone was asleep, she would creep down to that parlor and play above the keys, imagining that her parents could hear her. And she told me that when she was doing that, she thought about, okay, I'm safe, I have enough to eat, but this is not what my mother wanted for me. Because the whole story is based on the very precious words that my grandmother told my mother at the train station when she said goodbye. My grandmother gave my mother a gift. She told her, hold on to your music, Lisa. It'll be your best friend in life, and I'll be with you every step of the way through the music. So when my mother got to that Peacock Manor and couldn't even practice a piano, she thought, this is not what my family wanted for me. I've got to make something of my life. I've got to find a way to save my family. And in the most amazing decision, this 14-year-old girl wrote a note to the people in the Peacock Manor and said, thank you. I will never forget you, but I must go. Took a used red bike that she had bought with her save shillings and made her way back to the Brighton train station. With the money she had left, bought a ticket to London, knowing no one. Slept that night in the London train station and in the morning walked the miles to the Bloomsbury House, which was the headquarters of the Kinder Transport. Walked into the office of the director and said, my name is Lisa Yura. I'm 15 years old. I want to live among my own. I want to bring my family here to London. Sir, I'm going to make something of my life. I play the piano, and you're going to help me.
And she's greeted with this like long sigh from this poor guy who's got a million other things to worry
about. Unbelievable. He basically goes, absolute poppycock, and opens his mouth But he picks up the phone, calls Mrs. Cohen, who is a German Jew, more German than Jewish, who's running a hostel at 243 Willesden Lane, and amidst the screaming of Mrs. Cohen on the other end, says, I'm bringing this young girl over. You're going to find her delightful. And says to my mother, the two of you are going to get along famously, I'm sure of it. And my mother arrives there in the northern part of London, told me that she saw beautiful flowers, violets, lining the paveway, a kind of a disheveled three-story rambling building. But she really doesn't notice anything when she walks into the hostel, because in the far corner is a familiar object, and it's a piano. She walks over to that piano, lifts up the lid, hasn't played in a long time, but starts to pluck out the theme of the Grieg piano concerto. Dee-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da. And something magical happens. One by one, people come out of their rooms. One by one, the children come out of their rooms and they're hanging on the staircase. They're drinking in this music. The cook comes out of the kitchen, startled. Mr. Hardesty, the gentleman that ran the Bloomsbury House, stands there frozen. And in that moment, my mother's music became the music of their lives, the stories of their lives, what they had left behind in Europe. And she became sort of a symbol to all of them in that hostel. Through the music, they came together. And my mother would tell me many years later, obviously when she told me the story, how the kids would whistle, dee-ta-ta-ta-ta, when they saw each other in the streets. It became their mascot.
we don't want to minimize what a hard time this was, but in the moments of lightness, the place operated a lot like maybe a boarding school dorm, or these friendships formed among these young adults who, in addition to worrying about the fates of the people they cared about back home, were teenagers growing up and having crushes and having relationships. It's just such a complex environment.
That's a very powerful point, because even though there was tremendous sorrow at getting on that train and not knowing what was happening to your folks, they were still living in a safe place, in a hostel where people were kind to them. And it's very important to emphasize that I'm alive today, and so many of the children of these refugees, because of the generosity of British Christians, British Quakers and Methodists and Christians from all walks of life that came together with British Jews to pressure the British government to open the doors, to open the homes. We're alive today because of that movement that took place. What a brave thing. It was this clarion call that went out over the BBC radio right after Kristallnacht, this devastating event that took place. Because finally the Jews, many Jews woke up to say, the German Jews woke up. We thought we were German. We thought we were accepted. Everybody knew it was a desperation. You had to get your children out, as we discussed before. But these kids coming to England, at least they were in a safe environment. They had enough to eat to survive, although my mother always said there was a constant sense of hunger and rationing and whatnot. And as you said, these were young children, and somehow when you're young, there's a tremendous resilience. And if you have enough love, and Mrs. Cohen gave the love to these children, although she was a stiff kind of German lady there, she cared deeply about all of these kids. And so they could thrive in that environment, and they became sweethearts to each other and brothers and sisters to each other. Unlike many kinds of refugee camps that we know about today or that we have known about, where devastations take place, where young people are so scarred in the situation, these kids at least had a chance of being teenagers and experience first love and experiencing the growing up in that way, in spite of the tremendous not knowing what had happened to their family. They had hope, though. They had the faith, because each one of these children would tell me when I interviewed them that their parents said to them, "Don't worry, we're going to be reunited. We promise you that. And one day we'll all be together in America." That was the catchword that everybody thought, everybody felt and believed, that America was the land of hope. And in fact, after the war, when many of these children discovered the fate of their parents, because most of them were never reunited, with rare exception, most of them, the majority, immigrated to America.
Did they experience anti-Semitism in London?
I was never told that. There were some anti-refugee issues, sort of like what we did with the Japanese here during World War II, that young boys of a certain age that were from Germany or Austria were incarcerated in the Isle of Man. They were called friendly enemy aliens. And they were sent there, and then they were brought back. So several of the characters in the book and in my mother's story were indeed transported to the Isle of Man and then came back. One of them joined the RAF, joined the army afterwards. But my mother and these children never told me that they experienced any overt effect. If anything, they experienced a lot of affection and caring from the British people.
Some of the people we meet in the book start out as boys. They grow into young men. And I was thinking about how strange it would be to go in the same period of a few years from a child who was sent abroad to be protected from war to a young man who has chosen to participate in it.
I think that they felt very deeply what was going on with Hitler. They felt very deeply. I mean, there were rumors. They really did not know what was going on in terms of the Holocaust. That was really only discovered after the war. But I think at that young age, there is this desire to fight and make the world a better place and to fight evil. And there was such a clear evil in World War II. No one was disputing that. The evil was very defined, and it was Germany and Hitler.
playing at home was important to your mother, or playing at the hostel was very important, but Mrs. Cohen realized she needed more than that. How did it happen that she was able to train at one of the most prestigious conservatories in London at the time?
Well, several years into the hostel, one day Mrs. Cohen brought my mother into her bedroom and showed her a clipping from a British newspaper announcing that there were auditions for the London Royal Academy of Music. And I remember my mother telling me that she looked up at Mrs. Cohen and said, "Mrs. Cohen, why would the Academy accept me? I'm a Jewish refugee. I have no music. I have no teacher. I don't have a proper piano." And Mrs. Cohen, in her usual way, said, "Never mind." And with that, she set a program in place. My mother would come home from long days in the factory after she worked long hours on those machines. She would grab something to eat and go straight down into the basement where the piano had been placed for safekeeping during the war years and the bombing. And many of the kids that were her friends became her taskmasters. Gina would call out the notes, two notes, and say, "All right, identify for solfege and ear training." And so she would strike two notes, and my mother generally got it correct, but she wasn't very good at all that stuff. Gunter would ask her to, he would strike a note, and she would have to play the C major scale or the G major scale. I think that Johnny King Kong ordered her to play the Chopin scherzo over and over, and my mother thought, what was going on there? And then out of the corner of her eye, she told me she would see Johnny in a state of stupor, madly in love either with the music or with my mother. Of course, my mother always told me that each boy in the hostel was madly in love with her. And when I did the research, ironically and funny enough, I found that every boy, most of the boys, had a big crush on my mother because she was kind of a cross between a Viennese Sachertorte with a British accent, dressed to the nines, flaming red hair, made sure, as poor as she was, that her shoes matched her scarf, coiffed her hair in that style of the 40s, and just everything had to be put together perfectly. And especially when she eventually got a job later on and had a little more money, she really splurged on having the perfect dress and whatnot. So suffice it to say, she was a stunner when she walked into a room, and a huge flirt. Every boy that she knew, she would make sure that he felt he was the boy for her. And so I discovered later on that all these boys thought they were the boy for her. And so she had this fabulous kind of Viennese way about her, and that charm from another time. And each one of these kids helped her because she didn't have a teacher and a broken down piano. And ultimately, the day of the audition came, and she went, and she told me what it was like to walk into the London Royal Academy of Music. She saw long lines of smartly dressed British teenagers with their parents. How she missed her mother being by her side. Gunter went with her to the audition. He was the sweet boy in the hostel that became like a brother to her. But I don't want to give away to your audience what happened from the audition, because, again, I want folks to come and see the show and find out, did my mother triumph? Did she fulfill her dream? What happened to her parents? What happened to her sisters? It's an amazing story of a young girl coming of age. And what did she hold on to fulfill certain things?
Mrs. Cohen had a son named Hans, who your mother didn't meet right away. He was away at school, and it was sort of not explained why he was away. He became sort of a peer mentor to her.
Hans, who was blind from an anti-Semitic brawl, he was blinded by Nazi youth in Berlin, became a dear friend to my mother. He was the son of Mrs. Cohen. When that happened, Mrs. Cohen, who was more German than Jewish, knew that she had to find a way to save her life and his life. They got out on one of the trains to London. She was brought over to become a matron of one of the hostels through the Bloomsbury House, and found herself shocked taking care of 30 refugee children and her son. And yes, indeed, Hans was a pianist. He loved music very deeply, so my mother, coming to the hostel, had to have created a tremendous heartfelt connection between the two of them. And he did work with my mother. He coached her as best as she could. The amazing thing is that Hans is still alive. He's now approaching 93 years old. And recently we filmed him in London for the forthcoming documentary that we are in the process of editing right now. We were able to film Hans. We were able to film Gunther. We were able to film Gina and have interviews of them in a documentary called I Am a Pianist, that chronicles my journey to bring this story across America. We filmed in Birmingham, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Cleveland, Chicago, Hartford, bringing the story to students and communities across America and talking to them about this story and how it relates to them today in the challenges that they face in the 21st century.
What do you remember about your mother's way of teaching you to play the piano?
You know, no one has ever asked me that question. That's amazing. I remember her telling me, Mona, don't be nervous. When we were talking about my going out on stage, she said, it's natural to feel nervous, especially as a young kid. She would advise me to go into my heart and go out on stage and remember, just tell them a story. Tell them what's in your heart. What are you feeling? What is the music causing you to imagine? And we would put a lot of stories to the different music. It wasn't always my mother's music. It wasn't the particular pieces that she played. So I would find those stories, and she would also always tell me never worry about dropping a note or if you hit a wrong note. That's not what counts. Give a performance. Let your heart soar. Give it the most beautiful legato. Give it the greatest power. She felt, take a risk, even if you goof, but go for the gold in that way, in terms of being as passionate as you can.
My guest is Mona Golubek. She is the author of a book called The Children of Williston Lane. She's in town to perform a one-woman show tomorrow night at the Wiley Theater. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
As the streetcar descends the broad avenue and passes Symphony Hall, I close my eyes just as I do every Friday and imagine that I'm on the stage of this great hall, the Musikverein, seated at the grand piano, about to play the Grieg Piano Concerto. I've prepared for this moment my entire life. I've studied the concerto's every secret again and again. A hush falls over the audience. I straighten my back into the perfect posture that my mother has taught me. When the tension is unbearable, I take a breath and...
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard my guest, concert pianist and author and one-woman show performer, Mona Golubek. That was a selection from the show that she will perform tomorrow night at the Wiley Theater in Dallas. She's also the author of a 2002 book on the same material called The Children of Williston Lane, Beyond the Kinder Transport, a memoir of music, love, and survival. Mona, when I hear that, you were talking earlier about how difficult it was to get the words right as you're performing such a complex piece. In this one, you have all this really passionate acting, and then you instantly, I don't know if you change focus exactly, but suddenly you're playing something that I don't play the piano, but it sounds incredibly, incredibly difficult. Is that part easy, jumping into the music, because it's something you've done since, I gather, you were probably in preschool?
Well, some of the choices, the way the director programmed the play with the music, they align so perfectly. It's so dramatic. It's so passionate. And the words are passionate. So they kind of come together in a great marriage. Other times, for example, in the Clair de Lune, I'm uttering words that are very heartfelt. Again, though, there's an alignment, so it works. The most complex for me has been like the sewing event, because that was so off kilter with the rhythms, and then trying to get these words in so fast. It was almost like a rap artist trying to do that. And I've actually gotten faster as the 400 shows keep going. And so each piece has a challenge. I think with time I've just become more comfortable. It's become a part of my fabric. It's become a part of my heart. And I flow more easily into the characters and into the words with the music. But I quite marvel at the way, or I'm fascinated to hear how people who come to the show are struck by the fact that I'm talking and playing at the same time. They keep asking me when they line up for copies of the books that we sign after the shows, how do you do that? How do you speak and play at the same time? We've had people leave the theater and say, she's such an amazing actress. She really looks like a pianist out there.
What does practice look like for you these days?
I practice as much as I can. I'm a lot on the road. I think when you're doing a theatrical run, you feel pretty comfortable. Your nightly performances are almost like practicing in a way. I regret that I don't have enough time to build more repertoire right now. The Children of Willesden Lane and the Pianist of Willesden Lane has become my fervent mission, my fervent life right now. Had I known 20 years ago that this is where I would be now, 20 years later, building, I don't want to use the word brand, but if we could find another term for that, building a movement, shall we say, around my mother's story. As I shared with you earlier, my fervent goal is bringing this to young people, to students of diversity across America, and to their families, to the communities, through very large citywide reads that we do through our nonprofit. We hope very much we're starting a dialogue to do this here in Dallas, perhaps in 2016 or 2017, where teachers are taught how to teach the book. Students then read the book. They create projects around the book, original essays, paintings, videos. And then they are brought to an amphitheater or a large theater to experience an abridged version of the show and meet the heroine, daughter, the daughter of Lisa Yura. We've done this now in Birmingham, Montgomery, Los Angeles for 10,000 students a few months ago. We're doing it for around 8,000 students in Chicago this October, 8,000 students in Detroit this October. We are in discussions now and putting a plan for nearly 10,000 students in San Francisco in the fall of 2016. We're bringing it to the United Nations and the students there, as well as the students of New York. So this, I'm living my dream to see this story impact young people. And we receive so many letters and so many emails to our office telling us how this book has given young people a roadmap to think about really essential universal questions of how do they want to live their life. And one beautiful young student in San Francisco said to us when we were filming, well, I don't know what I want to do when I grow up, but I know that this book has taught me the kind of person I wish to be.
Hmm. Was there a moment in your childhood or your young adulthood when it really gelled for you that these things that were essentially family stories, that they were just part of, you know, your parents' legacy to you, were also an element of world history? Like, did you suddenly sit there in school and think, oh, they're talking about my mother?
Well, your question really brings up the whole issue of, are we alone on this earth, or are we a part of a humanity? At least that's what I feel from your words. What's our purpose here? And I look at myself just as a conduit to tell the story. She passed it on to me. I'm passing it on to others. But in related to your question, we were never, when I was growing up, there was not a time where they taught the Holocaust in the public school that I went to. But of course, they taught World War II. They might have skimmed on it a little bit. And in fact, there are only 7 states that make Holocaust teaching mandatory.
Is that right?
Only 7 in our country. I think it may be touched upon, but it's only mandatory in 7 states like California, Illinois, New York, New Jersey. I don't have them all under my belt right now to name. But I think that teachers, whom I think are our heroes, are out there trying to address these issues of continuing Holocausts and genocide and bullying and prejudice and anti-this or anti-that. And so I look at this as a privilege in my own small way of bringing this one story to those out there and hoping that it's universal enough that it relates to today, because that's the most important thing. The survivors are dying out. Those that work with me don't look at this per se as a Holocaust story, but really as a more global story of a young girl holding on to something, her life saved by other people who were not of her religion, having the generosity to do that, opening their hearts and souls, and kids coming together, finding through the music. And we impart in our citywide reads or the theatrical productions, find whatever it is. Is it your poetry? Is it your sports? Is it computer sciences? Find that passion. Find that faith. Going back to your story and coming full circle, I do wish to share with your listeners that when I was a little girl and my mother taught me the piano and told me this story and put me to sleep at night, she kept telling me this story. So in a way, I had no choice. It branded my heart in a way. It set my destiny. It set my path in life. Little did I realize it. She had lost so much, so I was her best friend. And the dream that she had to become a concert pianist was cut short. So in a way, I fulfilled that dream. I came out, I went forth, I became the concert pianist, but I did more. Just as she kept her promise to her mother and fulfilled the dream and became a pianist, so I keep a promise and I go out on that stage to pay tribute to her life, to those beautiful people in England that saved her life, and to every mother and father who had the courage to save their child by saying goodbye.
Mona, as you've worked on this project and you've done all of these live performances and written the book, I wonder if questions have occurred to you that you realize you didn't ask your mother, you didn't speak with her about, or are they the kinds of things that even if you didn't have the conversation, you have a really good sense of what she would have answered?
Well, when she knew that I was working on this book on her life, there was a kind of conflict for her. She was on one part excited, one part touched, but another part hesitant and cautious. You're exposing your life to others. She wondered probably what I was going to reveal about all those boys in the hostel in a way. I think we had such a close relationship. She was my best friend ever. I couldn't even contemplate losing her, which I ultimately did. I think I asked her pretty much everything I needed to know. And the things that I didn't ask her, she communicated in other ways. She let me know. I knew about the heart that was broken, the part of the chamber of the heart that was broken. I received what I needed to receive through the music, through her. She told me the story, all the stories, through the way that she would play the piano. No one played the piano like her. She may not have had all the notes right, but her phrasing of a Chopin nocturne or of a Beethoven 32 variations was so sublime through the music, I knew who Lisa Yura was.
Do your hands look like hers?
Well, she had shorter fingers. We would laughingly say that she had stubby little shorter fingers. I have longer ones. But I will tell you, the joke was that when I came out of her womb, apparently she would tell folks, the very first thing I did, I brought Mona home, and then I placed those little fingers on the keyboard to see how soon she could stretch into a Rachmaninoff prelude.
Her mother told her, whether I'm physically there or not, when you play the piano, I will be there with you. Do you feel that she's there with you every time you sit down to play?
Every night when I walk out on stage, I never take for granted what I'm doing. And right before I walk out on stage, I hold a Star of David given to my mother by one of the boys in the hostel, and I rub it, I feel it for a second, because I want to walk out on that stage and make sure that each performance every night makes a difference, and my mother is with me out there on stage every night.
Does each performance feel different to you?
Yes. I go into different memories every night because it's most important to refresh and find something to deepen the story, the telling of it. Otherwise, you'll become stale. That was what the acting coach sort of advised me on. He also said to me, Mona, if it doesn't cost you every night, walk away.
That's a hard way to earn a living.
I don't necessarily look at this now, at this point in my life, as a living. I look at it as a deep purpose and a deep mission.
How do you know a particularly good night from a decent but average night?
You really feel your audience. I really feel the audience out there. You know when their hearts are with you. It's hard to even explain. I don't know how I know it, but I do. And I, for the most part, have to say I've been very blessed that I've had wonderful audience reactions to the story. And as I said, I have my mother that walks out with me. I have the legacy of these children, Mrs. Cohen, Mr. Hardesty, my grandmother. All of these people are counting on me to tell the story.
Mona Golubek is a concert pianist and author of the 2002 book, The Children of Williston Lane, Beyond the Kinder Transport, a memoir of music, love, and survival. The one-person show she'll perform tomorrow night at the Wiley Theater is The Pianist of Williston Lane. Mona, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. On Twitter, I am at Chris Boyd Think. If you would like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.